Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Good morning to you out there in podcast land. This is Abe Thompson coming to you on the New Cyber Frontier broadcast. I'm broadcasting currently from, or podcasting more effectively, from the SecureSet campus here in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I serve as the director of this campus where we provide cybersecurity boot camps and training to put professionals out in the industry. I have the privilege of sitting in for my friend and colleague, Mr. Chris Gorog, who is obviously the eminent star of this podcast. And it is indeed for me morning, but whenever you're listening, we're glad to have you out there. Today we have, as a special guest, Mr. David Kruger, who's the Vice President of Business Development, or actually previously you were the founding CEO of Air Partnership Professionals, but you're now the Vice President of Business Development for ABSIO. Mr. Kruger, good morning.
Good morning.
So welcome, good to have you with us. Tell me a little bit about your experience in the industry. You've got quite a bit of credential with you. You've got some software support, you've got business development, you've got marketing, particularly in the aviation industry. So tell me a bit about your path to get where you've been.
Well, the aviation business was actually, I ran a software development team. I have also been the VP of software development at Apsio, and I'm one of the founders. But my primary background is in safety engineering, not in cyber. I got into cyber when I worked with my brother to stand up a company here in Colorado Springs that did construction plans online. This was back in 1999, and had that company, we sold it, then we did another company, then we sold it, then we did another company, and we sold that, and then we started Apsio Corporation.
Excellent. And it's actually a good segue when you think about safety engineering, really moving into a more technology pervasive society and things going on around us. So it sounds like a sort of a perfect fit and a perfect glove. What inspired you initially to make this venture?
Well, I'd been doing a lot of work in software development, actually all the way back into the 80s, just okay. As an adjunct to my my work in safety. There's a tremendous amount of parallelism between the two, because you're essentially looking for something that that you want to contain and control, because it's hazardous if you don't.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of the sort of auditing type of principles and thinking about how you make things safe that are very, very synonymous to how you make things secure. So I got really into the software business with this first company here in Colorado Springs, which is actually just a few blocks down the street on Wasatch. And then kind of never went back, or as I say, I went to the dark side. I went to cyber and to the software world full time after that. But the safety thinking has informed to a very significant degree how we approach the problem of cybersecurity, right? So that's it was a good background for our decision for how we would approach solving the cybersecurity problem.
Sure. Well, and of course, when we say safety, the connotation there is that there are threats and there are dangers. Describe sort of your assessment of the dangers that exist that we need to address.
Well, when you're in the in the safety engineering profession, you essentially start everything with a root cause analysis, and the reason you do that is because the further upstream you can solve a problem, you tend to be able to solve it more effectively, and over time you tend to be able to solve it more cheaply, more effectively, and so forth. So, back in when we started this, it's just like today, there was the breach of the day news. And that was basically a problem of data exfiltration. Somebody got access to data that they weren't supposed to have. And when we did the initial sort of root cause analysis, we determined that the fundamental problem, the root condition, was the way that applications make files. The way that they files, bytes, streams, right? Structured data and semi-structured data and so forth, because that's what people actually had access to. The applications of all sorts, right, make files that are by default unsecure and uncontrollable, so that just gaining possession of them by whatever means, stolen device, malware that's going to exfiltrate content off of a system and into another system, as long as we solely focused on perimeter security and didn't solve that fundamental underlying problem, we could, the progress that we could make for the data security aspect of cybersecurity, it was going to be limited. That was our thinking.
Excellent. Thank you, Dave. Let's take a break there for our first sponsor.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
And we're back here in the break. I had just started a discussion with Mr. Kruger about how long he'd been in the Springs, and he was kind of explaining his journey. Would you recap some of that for us?
Yeah, we sold the initial software company that we stood up, the Construction Plans Online, in 2003, and then I moved back to the Dallas area, the North Dallas area, and then we stood up a company that did web parts for SharePoint, customized web parts, and then we sold that company in 2008, and then we were casting around for what to do next. In the meantime, I've done the aviation software company. And then we started this company in earnest in 2010 to just approach the cybersecurity problem.
Yeah.
We got a pretty good sized military contract, which is where we really got to develop the technology that we'd been doing about 2 years worth of stealth engineering on at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And then we grew quite a bit, but unfortunately, that like a lot of people in this business, that contract was sequestered.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had to make a shift from a solely military focus, military intelligence community basically focused, to a more commercial focus.
And that's certainly a standard for our environment here in Colorado Springs. We ebb and flow with sort of the DoD process for sure.
Yeah.
We are such a high DoD concentration here. And I deal with that quite a bit in looking at the workforce issue as we try to put students into various cybersecurity jobs here. The challenge is, where is DoD? You know, what's DoD's emphasis? You know, clearances, et cetera. So before we went to the break, you'd highlighted a couple of the more specific things that you'd done on your journey. And you talked about one of the big problems being the way we construct our applications, or the way applications were constructed. Can you unpack that a bit for us?
Well, yeah, you go back to you know, ancient history in the in the digital world. The first digital files were laid down on tape, right? No hard drives back.
I've heard of this.
This is about 1955. So the challenge back then was simply to make something that you could, okay, we're going to take this body of information, we're going to turn it into ones and zeros, we're going to put some metadata on top of it, and what they called right then a header, right, mm-hmm. still around, mm-hmm. that says, you know, here's some metadata about this file that allows you to find it, to be able to open it back up, to be able to edit it, or be able to close it back down, to be able to delete it, to be able to package it up and send it somewhere else. And if you look at the, you know, absolutely stunning progress we've made since 1995, the one area where we do things exactly the same manner that we did in 1955 is the way that we form files, right? And again, the challenge back then wasn't to keep it secure. The challenge was to be able to open it, edit it, delete it, and move it, right? You know, so we essentially, I mean, the formatting of the header and things like that has changed over time, but that file or that byte or that stream really hasn't changed.
Sure.
And it's that inherent vulnerability that merely possessing it gives you access to the information as long as you have software that can read recognize it as this file type, read the header, open it up, and display it. You've got access to the information. So that fundamental problem is what we are trying to solve.
So the fundamental problem remains using archaic methodology, and we see that in many other places. Having retired from government service, of course, I can relate to how the government remains, so cutting edge in so many areas and yet so archaic in others. And it's interesting, 1955 was a formidable year for technology sort of in society when Walt Disney kind of made his big splash and some of the things that he did. So you think that good things happened in 1955, but you've definitely highlighted some of the vulnerability that remains. What are you doing to attack it and address it and kind of restage our thinking? It's really a paradigm shift.
Yeah, it is a paradigm shift. So essentially, let me go back and give you a little bit of history and how we ended up on this initial military contract. Army G2, Army Intelligence, mm-hmm. was in need. We were still in the thick of things in Iraq and Afghanistan. Realized early on that they needed the capability to wage asymmetric warfare. Part of that capability was to be able to have portable data, tablets, laptops, a phone in the warfighter's hand so that he could do things like access a good guy, bad guy database with right. images on his phone because, they weren't wearing uniforms. Right? We need to know who people were, but the problem was, what happens if that device gets into somebody else's hands? Yeah. What happens if that device gets shipped off to a very unfriendly nation state and subjected to a nation state hack? They had portable towed 3G networks, behind an MRAP or a Farman Humvee that they would pull around in the theater, right? So these guys could communicate, or at least this was the theory. You also had to be able to protect the data that was on that server in the same way, right? You had to defeat it against intercept, capture, actually having physical possession of the hardware. You had to figure out how to keep the data secure. That was problem number one, and that was actually, in some ways, the easier problem to solve. The additional problem is that we had coalition partners that we could not, for political reasons, adequately vet, that we had to share this information. So they had to be able to extend control of the information to be able to maintain visibility to it, be able to delete it on demand, be able to make it expire at a date certain, even when that data was on somebody else's network or device.
Sure.
And the way our technology works, we solved that fundamental problem, so we spent the first few years building out a tactical battlefield communication system, which is just really a fancy way of saying Army intelligence email, right? That would survive all the potential security problems and control problems that they had, not only in their network, but when it was shared in coalition partners networks.
Sure. Well, and I know that all too well, having been on the Navy side of that, even back in 90. And 89, 90 going forward, that time frame. But I also think back to stories I've heard about in Vietnam. We had vulnerabilities in addition to the physical vulnerabilities from the enemy. We had environmental vulnerabilities. So if you've heard these stories, they would they use cards in those days, and they take the computer cards. They'd have to run from one trailer to another trailer rapidly to protect it from humidity, even so that the data would actually transfer safely. And because if not, the things would wilt. So you've got the enemy, you've got environmental concerns, and so it's interesting that the reality of that constant threat, whatever environment we're in, does exist. And it's good to know we have solutions that are being posed that are actually going to address these things. As the as the information exchange methodology and media changes, certainly the types of problems we face are similar. And so we can bring some of those lessons from history forward. So solution, you've got some solutions in place that really helped sort of in an Army environment. Talk to me more about the data exfil.
Okay, so I mean, part of this is pretty simple. If you exfil an encrypted file, you know, what have you got? You've got an encrypted file, right?
Correct.
And then, you know, basically, you know, if you're using a good encryption algorithm, a good strong algorithm, AES-256 or something like that, properly implemented, you really don't have much, right? So what our stuff is implemented in SDKs into existing normal, you know, existing and new applications, right? So it intercepts a file when it's formed, and it encrypts it with its own unique key. I'm saying file, but that's shorthand for files, byte streams,
right.
Semi-structured, structured, unstructured data.
Data.
Right? So it grabs that, and then it gives it its own unique key, and then if our SDK is utilized this way, it is never decrypted again, ever, except in memory temporarily when the file is opened, and it's only decrypted for a cryptographically authenticated user.
Sure. Well, thank you. Let's take another break and hear from our sponsors.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
And we're back. We were just talking about your SDKs. And for the benefit of our audience and me, break out your description there.
An SDK is a software development kit, you know, industry acronym. It just means here's a package of functions, or otherwise called a library, right, that you incorporate into software. And a lot of software is built where the software development team will go off and find these libraries or software development kits that have functions that they need, and they will just make it part of the software application.
Yeah. We used to talk about description files as well, which were similar, very much the same. I remember. And of course, you and I could reminisce, it sounds like, all day with regard to sort of the military environment and intel in that realm. Let's bring some of the others in our audience forward to your technology and the advances you've made in your career to the corporate realm, private sector. What applications have you seen? Obviously,
well,
the industries you're in are very different.
Yeah, the SDKs, the software development kits, have only recently become publicly available.
Sure.
And we're back in the military world, but we're back in the government world with these now, doing some generalized applications that I can't discuss in any detail.
Been there, done that.
Right, but for Department of Homeland Security and people like that, where they need for the data. And again, the commercial needs and the military needs are not different.
No.
If you're going to secure your data, it doesn't really matter what the application is secure. If you need to extend control to that of that data when it's on somebody else's network or device, those are the same needs that business has.
Positively.
So we've started our first development projects using those SDKs, but they're back on the government side.
Sure.
Right. So we're finishing out the rest of the languages, the rest of the platforms, right, to be able to develop different kinds of software here over the next few months, and then moving more in the commercial world. Interestingly, from a broad commercial perspective and just a normal user perspective, the thing that is the big driver for us is not happening here. It's happening in Europe. It's the General Data Protection Regulation, where they are now, for the first time, required to do a risk assessment on the data. And if it's risky to what they call the data subject, the person whose data it is, if it meets a certain degree and kind of risk, essentially they have to be able to encrypt and control that data, even when it's being shared among companies who are working on this sort of common data set. And that is We think that that regulation goes into effect May 25th, 2018, and it affects every company in the world that does business in Europe.
And that's a European Union standard, or is that implemented?
Yeah, it's an EU-UK standard, but the what they call the territorial scope of it is if you're a U.S. company and you have information on British or German or Swiss data subjects, then you're required to comply with the regulation in order to continue to do business in Europe.
Now, it sounds quite revolutionary. Let's talk about sort of the business impact. Let's talk about a typical technology company, business with multiple European Union or countries or the UK itself. What's the initial impact you're going to see?
Well, they're going to have to be able to document that they're in conformance. And the documentation burden is pretty steep. They have to start by they have to inventory all of their data. They have to map all the flows of that data. They have to do a risk assessment and say that this data either requires a higher level protection or not, and here is my impact. And then they have to be able to show in detail how they are actually securing that data in the manner prescribed by the regulation. And interestingly, essentially the only there's not a framework. They don't refer to like a NIST standard or something like that. They simply say that the data security has to be sufficient to protect the data subject's rights.
Individual rights.
The only technologies that they mention in this entire 218-page long standard is encryption and what they call pseudonymization. It's very difficult to say, but it's essentially the same thing. It's making sure that if somebody gets access to that data that's not supposed to have it, that it's unreadable.
So how truly distinct is that from sort of the RMF standard that, you know, that we're seeing rolled out here in the States? How much more work do we really have to do in our individual companies to kind of meet that standard?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. Because you can't get there from here with perimeter security, because the what is sufficient, the definition of sufficient is intelligible to somebody post breach.
Sure.
Right, that's the standard.
Well, it sounds like dangerously subjective rather than sort of an objective.
I don't think it's dangerously subjective. I actually think it's a very smart standard. They also require that you document that you're using state-of-the-art technology.
Okay.
Right.
So do they describe that?
No. It points down to here's the bottom line. If you're GDPR regulated, God help you if you have a breach.
Wow. Yeah.
And the penalties. Right, for violating a data subject's rights in terms of just the breach portion of it, just getting into their hands, there's other penalties for not doing a good job.
Sure.
And those penalties can compound. But the highest level of penalty is either 4% of your gross global revenue or 20 million euros, whichever is higher.
Yeah. Well, and this really brings home something I'm always trying to impress upon my students, and I'm sure Chris does as well, this concept of the stakes are high. A lot of my students come from a veteran background, so defense background, so they're defense-minded. But as we enter to the private sector, the reality is that the stakes remain high, and we're still sort of in a defense mode. And so I think a lot of that mentality and that diligence still needs to apply. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, this is going to be a tough software problem. It's going to be, in a lot of cases, an even tougher risk management problem, because it creates a sort of a new framework for understanding, for companies understanding risk.
Yeah.
If they do business in Europe, or if they're in Europe, right?
Sure.
If they do business with European citizens, I should say. It's going to force a change in risk management philosophy that actually is a lot closer to safety than it has been the way we normally judge risk for cybersecurity.
Well, it's truly a global problem, just because of the nature of global business. Now, what resistance might you expect sort of in the hearts and minds of the standard American entrepreneur as they address some of these things?
Well, first and obvious is it's going to be expensive.
Yeah.
All right. But the second thing, it kind of depends on the vertical that they're in, because the two fundamental things that come out of the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, right? So trying to de-acronym this thing.
Oh, sure.
is two things that come out of it. One of it is that the persons whose data it is owns the data, mm-hmm. not the company who's controlling it and processing it. The second thing from a legal standpoint, which is enormous compared to how we look at cybersecurity risk in the U.S., is that you do not have to prove harm, right? Explicitly, you do not have to prove harm. So harm is totally subjective to the data subject or subjects whose data has been breached.
Sure.
Right? You don't have to harm them. You don't have to go into court and prove harm. They just have to not like it in order to do things like certify a class action lawsuit.
Sure. And that's certainly frightening. Kind of as you move away from any sense of an absolute, it's in the mind of the individual.
Well, and again, it's predicated that on a different thing than, say, marketing companies and search engine companies have here in the United States. We have the thing, well, you know, you gave us our data, your data, you can, or whether we had permission or not, it's ours and we can do what we want to with it. The fundamental belief is that your data is something that is tangible that you own.
Sure, intellectual capital
Everything in the regulation is based on that philosophy, and that is a sea change, mm-hmm. which I think is eventually going to trickle back here to the United States for companies that are not doing business in Europe. It sets a new bar, it sets a new set of expectations of, hey, it's my data, I'm in control of it, you can't do with it what I don't permit you to do explicitly, and you have to be able to prove to me on demand that you are treating my data and using and processing my data in the manner which I have permitted you to do.
Well, it's interesting when you refer to it as a sea change. Certainly it is in the industry, but if you kind of think back to the Age of Enlightenment, sort of the way philosophy changed even throughout Europe, the Enlightenment era, it's interesting that it's coming from Europe, that elevation of the individual and the individual thought. So
frankly, it's a little disappointing to me that it's not coming from here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you think about the way this country was founded and sort of individual being of value and protection of individuals. And certainly it brings to light some of the gross negligence, actually, that we probably see in the United States in terms of privacy and protection, and then the vulnerables, right?
Yeah.
The young kids, you know, I think from an education perspective and as a parent, you know, really some of this really should have come from the great minds that are here.
Yeah, as I said, it's a little disappointing that when you talk about defending personal property rights, mm-hmm. and keep your hands off my stuff, whether you're a company or a government or somebody down the street, sort of the philosophy, it's a little disappointing that didn't come from here.
Sure, sure.
But nonetheless, they are taking the lead on this, and they've got a very draconian set of penalties because they are dead serious. If you're going to do business in Europe, you have to comply with this regulation or we'll cut you off.
Is it gonna shut some people down?
I think so. I think that in the next few years, we're going to see sort of on a global level, particularly in companies who have traded in other people's information in a way that's invisible to those people, and that there's no permissioning structure. I think they're going to be very, very challenged. They're going to have to either figure out how to conform or they're going to have to lose their European markets. And again, mm-hmm. I think that sets expectations. And this is not going to be a fast process.
Oh, definitely.
But it's, you know, how come I can go there and people have to have my permission, which I can rescind at any time, to use my data, right? And when I come here, there's not that level of respect for my privacy. I think there's also a mechanical aspect to that. If you're a business in the U.S. that has to conform with the GDPR, are you going to run two systems?
Yeah.
Or are you going to run one? So it's going to be a very interesting and challenging environment. And again, because privacy, the difference between privacy and security, companies have security, individuals have privacy,
right.
But functionally, these are the same things.
Yeah,
it's
true.
Controlling what people, we'll go back to what we do, controlling what people do when my information is on their network and devices.
Interesting.
Having visibility and control into that.
Have you heard any hints of legislation or lawmakers here in the states that are wise to this yet?
A little bit, but mostly it's been fear and dismay and an earnest attempt to figure out how to not have to comply with
right.
it. But I'm a GDPR practitioner. Yeah. I've actually mm-hmm. certified, taken my tests and things like that, so I'm pretty familiar with the regulation and the legal landscape around it. I don't think there's much chance of escape.
So any of our lawmakers that are out there, his name is David Krueger. He has that expertise. One last little thing as we kind of wrap up our discussion, and just what a fascinating story that you've weaved through in your professional life. Auditing. Where are we going next with the concept of auditing?
Well, the go back to the GDPR again. Mm-hmm. Since that's what we've been talking about, it is a very much an audit-based. They call it the principle of accountability,
yeah. mm-hmm.
right? And that principle of accountability is all about auditability yeah. of your decision-making processes, of the systems in place, of how you're maintaining them. How do you know that your data security administrative procedures and technical procedures actually work? Uh-huh. What was the reasoning behind choosing one technology over the other? Show me documentation that you're actually doing things like patching in a timely fashion. All of that has to be auditable on demand anytime what the country authority, it's called supervisory authority. If they ask for it, you have to produce it.
Well, and that's certainly...
So audit is huge.
Certainly a good thing for stockholders and stakeholders and probably across the industry, this could be certainly revolutionary, maybe one of the next big things. I think of the sea change that do you remember 8570 brought us in the military, and how radically that did impact the way we operated.
I think the other potential big driver in this is if insurance companies, the global mm-hmm. insurance yeah. companies, see a better claims experience in Europe over the next few years than they do in other places in the world. I think, again, very much like the safety industry, the insurance companies tell you what your safety standards are.
Correct.
They're not really doing that so much here in the U.S. in any kind of explicit fashion, and they don't have engineering teams that they field. If the GDPR goes this way, I think that you're going to see insurers begin to say, you need to adopt this because yeah. it's going to make them more money.
Certainly. And then you'll see more from the legal and the insurance industries seeking after sort of the cybersecurity expertise, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, my name is Abe Thompson. I'm podcasting here from the SecureSec campus here in Colorado Springs. I'm with Mr. David Krueger, who's just brought us a diverse set of problems, but also someone who can articulate a really good solution, and it's a pleasure to know that you're out there and doing this work for our industry and really for the folks here in this country and in our economy, but also for the world of cybersecurity. So it's been a pleasure to spend the time with you, and I trust we will hear continuing great things.
And thank you for having me.
The views or opinions expressed by me during this podcast are my own and are not those of my employer, Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.